from KXJZ in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. In a typical city, incomes and home ownership go hand in hand, but not in San Francisco. The city's highest home ownership rates are in places where incomes are lowest. Find out why today on Insight. So today in Uzbekistan, women musicians traditionally play indoors away from the eyes and ears of strangers. A virtuoso Uzbek musician will explain why, and she'll play in our studio. Plus, a Sacramento man has put his huge collection of Beatles memorabilia up for sale. He says it's worth $1 million or more. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, in San Francisco's richest district, home ownership is only 27%. In the city's poorest districts, home ownership is as high as 70%. How can that be? We'll find out. Also, he calls it the ultimate Beatles collection. A Sacramento area man puts his stock of Beatles memorabilia up for sale, claiming a total value of $1 million or more. First, a virtuoso musician from Uzbekistan visits Davis tonight to tell the story of women and music in her homeland. It's a performance lecture called Love Terrestrial, Love Divine. Musician Razia Sultanova teaches at the University of London, but right now she's touring the U.S. Her specialty is the folk and classical music of Uzbekistan, including the repertoire traditionally played indoors by women. Razia Sultanova is in our studio. Razia, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be with you today.
Why is women's music in Uzbekistan traditionally played behind closed doors?
Because Uzbekistan, if you know, is a Muslim area, so female life is separated from male life, and that's why each household has a different part, you know, special part for women to live there, and it's in the farthest, you know, corner of the yard, which means women live there with children. They gather all together, they play their music, and very often men are not aware of it.
Is that still the case today?
Oh, yes. In traditional society, in rural society, you know, 2/3 of population of Uzbekistan and Central Asia, they live in villages, which means even today, this household, traditional household, has this separation, you know, when there is a sitting room for visitors, for people from outside, and there is a part of house called Ichkari, which is in the corner of the yard, and it's the place where all music happens, music making is going on.
If you were to see musicians in Uzbekistan playing contemporary music, would it be the same there too?
No, not at all. You're right. Pop music is sounding everywhere in Tashkent, in Kazakhstan, you know, in Almaty and other big cities. But, you know, in towns and in villages, people still play traditional music.
When women are playing traditional Uzbek music behind closed doors, are they playing a different kind of music than the men of Uzbekistan do?
Today, everything seems to be, you know, the same. I mean, repertoire, male and female repertoire is almost the same. But in the past, women did play music on dutar. It was the only instrument allowed for women to play in Muslim Uzbekistan and in Muslim Turkestan and Central Asia. That's why in repertoire, in classical repertoire of dutar, there are some pieces which belong to female repertoire. Only female performers played it in the past. And that was my reason, you know, to learn it from my female teacher. I have my teacher, you know, in Uzbekistan, and she explained to me that these pieces used to be played only by women.
You mentioned the dutar, and that's what you're holding.
Yes, absolutely. So it's long-necked black lute made of mulberry tree, and it has very gentle voice because dutar has two strings, and it's twisted silken strings. Actually, in a way, dutar is a symbol of the Great Silk Road. You see, mulberry tree and silken strings, they are all products of the same item, of the same tree. And the sounds of dutar is very much connecting us to the past, because dutar was used to be played either in the palaces for evening entertainment or in the houses of noble women, noble families, noble men. And that was once again evening entertainment, you know, to enjoy the meal, to enjoy gathering with friends and to enjoy music.
You have a song for us that that is named after the dutar.
Yes. First piece I wanted to play for you called Dutarim, which means my dutar, and it means my friend dutar, someone to share all your secrets, you know, all your stories.
Okay. Thank you, Razia Sultanova, with the song Dutarim, which means my friend dutar, and that's the name of the instrument she's playing. Tell us more about why the dutar is associated with women musicians.
Well, as I told you, in Islamic area of Central Asia, in particular in Uzbekistan, in the great cities like Fergana, Kokand, Bukhara, Samarkand, Khwarezm, you know, female performance was actually banned. Public performance was forbidden for female musicians. But somehow this instrument survived, and it was mystery for me. I'd done my research related to this question just to understand why this instrument has survived all restrictions or all possible kinds of limits. I found that the voice of dutar is so quiet, so gentle, that most probably nobody heard what women actually playing, you know, in their part of the houses. Maybe that was the explanation, because it's not this penetrating, you know, doesn't have the penetrating sound of wind instruments, you know, or brass instruments. It's very quiet. It's just, you know, for chamber, you know, sound, for chamber environment, for several people, you know, for the closest friends of the family. And that's why most probably nobody heard it. By the way, in a very interesting book miniature by in the 16th century by Zahiruddin Behzad, there are very interesting depictions of female performers who played within the palaces. According to the famous Alisher Navai poet, his poems of Hamsa, Shah Bahram, or Emperor of Bahram, was visiting every day of the week different princesses. And Behzad, an artist who produced this series of book miniature, clearly depicted female musicians who played this fantastic instrument. So it's the evidence from 16th century that women played within the palaces, you know, for court ceremonies. Certainly we don't have names of these musicians. Unfortunately, they not survived. But as usually, who does all documentary and chronics in the history? Men. So that's why female names were
there. Sure. Do you think Uzbek women in the past, and maybe today too, I guess, resent the fact that they had to play indoors and that they could only play the dutar?
No, today Uzbek women do play all possible instruments. We have fantastic, wonderful singers who conquered the world with their voices. One is Munajat Yulchiva. She is performing makam tradition, classical art music, which is the genre which goes back to medieval time. There is another one, Yulduz Usmanova, who is a well-known, fantastic pop singer. You know, it's kind of Uzbek Madonna, if you like. And she is also touring the world. She produced a great amount of CDs. So certainly today Uzbek performers and Uzbek women, they do, conquer the world with their musical talents, and the situation has changed today.
Do you often go back to Uzbekistan?
Oh, yes, every year. You know, I still have family there, and it's the area of my research anyway. I'm very happy.
What is the language of Uzbekistan like? Is it related to Turkish or to Persian?
Absolutely. It's related to Turkish language because it's Turkic family of languages. So Uzbek language as a language of literature and poetry was established in the 15th century. It was called Chagatai language. But Turkish language, if you know, was established in 18th century. So we do understand Turkish language when Turks don't understand Uzbek language. It's quite funny.
Uzbekistan is a landlocked country. It has many neighbors around it, and to the south is Afghanistan. Could you tell us what the people in Uzbekistan think about the instability in Afghanistan? There was a long time ago the Soviet invasion, the Taliban, the U.S.-led invasion. There's a government with weak authority over the provinces, and still today you have NATO forces fighting Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces. How does Uzbekistan feel about all that going on to the south?
It's an excellent question, because 2 weeks ago I was in Afghanistan doing my field work in the northern part of Afghanistan, northern provinces, and I worked with Uzbek musicians. So my answer is not a political one, because I was interested mostly how Uzbek music have survived in this Uzbek diaspora, because it's about 3 million Uzbeks live in the northern part of Afghanistan, and I went to this tiny, you know, very distant villages and cities to discover for myself that they do play music, and music is very vital, vitally important for their life today. They still listen to Uzbek radio. They still keep their Uzbek language education in schools. All their children, they speak Uzbek language, and they still perform all possible instruments, and music means for them, you know, so much that they do musical instruments which are not any longer in use in Uzbekistan itself. They perform wedding songs, they perform classical art music, they perform even pop songs, you know, when they hear them on the radio from Uzbekistan. But certainly they influenced very much by Afghani culture in a way, because, you know, keyboards is also one of the most popular, and other instruments like Afghani rubab, the king of musical instruments in Afghanistan, which has nothing to do with Uzbek culture. However, this instrument is very much in use, you know, very popular in Uzbek population. So that was very interesting for me to discover. Afghani people, they experiencing very difficult time, because they don't know who to believe, but they would like to live in peace. They're very tired from wars, you know, and all these turmoils which produced, yes, politics, you know, politicians.
I can imagine.
Yes, but music still to be vitally important for them.
Could you give us one more song, please?
Yes.
What's the song?
So it's called Gilos, and in translation it means flourishing cherry. And certainly somehow this piece of music related to the music and culture of the Great Silk Road.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's Razia Sultanova, who's giving a recital and lecture this evening at UC Davis called Love Terrestrial and Love Divine, Women and Music in Uzbekistan. There's more information about it on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Razia, thank you so much for coming by today.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a Sacramento area man who's put his huge collection of Beatles memorabilia up for sale. He says it's been valued at $1 million or more. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. This song is for sale, or rather a mint version of the 1967 single release of the song, I Am the Walrus, is up for auction along with nearly 300 other Beatles items. They're all from the collection of Sacramento area man Stan Panenka. He says the total value has been estimated at $1 million or more, and he hopes to complete the sale in the next few days. He's on the phone. Stan Panenka, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you.
You've been building your collection for years. Why are you selling it?
I'm selling it because I want to buy a dream home for my mom.
And where's your mom? Is she around these parts?
Yeah, she lives in Rancho Cordova.
And do you know which home you're going to buy?
No, not yet, but I got an area picked out.
Okay. Could you tell us, what's the highlight of your of what you call the ultimate Beatles collection?
The first sealed first date Butcher cover, the Decca single, My Bonnie, and the Anna Perlmutter single, introducing the Beatles, the add-back, stereo add-back, another sealed mono Butcher cover.
What do you mean by a Butcher cover?
The Butcher cover meaning that when it first came out, it was, you know, the Beatles dressed in smocks with these covered with dolls and stuff like that, and what that was withdrawn, and then they reissued it with a, what they call a trunk version, so it was pasted over.
And did you say that these were sealed covers?
Yeah, these are sealed. Yeah, those two are sealed. Yes.
You mean they were sealed when they were sold, or you sold, or you sealed them?
No, it was sealed by Capitol themselves.
A Capitol being the record label,
right?
And why would they seal them?
Well, they always seal them. They seal them since about 64 and on. They sealed all the albums.
And you mentioned My Bonnie. Of course, that was before they were really the Beatles.
Right. They were called the Beat Brothers with Tony Sheridan. They were the backup, you know, the backing group.
Now, what's the most unusual item in your collection?
The most unusual item? Well, probably the commercial My Bonnie, you know, with Tony Sheridan and Beat Brothers. That's definitely unusual.
And why is that unusual?
Because they made very few of those, and there's only about like 20 in known existence, and again, they were called the Beat Brothers and not the Beatles at that point.
Do you have any strange items in the collection, or are they all records?
No, they're all records. Nothing really strange about it.
Now, you say in your website, ultimatebeatlescollection.com, that you feel this collection is worth $1 million or more. Could you tell us why you think it's worth $1 million?
That's what the experts tell me. The experts told me that they're worth $1 million or more because it's you know, a lot of records in there that are the best you know condition worldwide, and most of those are the most you know valuable and historic records.
Hmm. And have you actually shown the collection to these other collectors, or do you just describe it to them?
I describe it to them.
Yeah.
There's a few dealers who've seen my you know my collection.
Are you still adding to the collection?
No, not right now.
Are you selling everything that's in your collection?
Yeah, I'm selling it as a whole. I really don't want to break it up. That's the world's number one collection, and you know, it's just it should be actually in a museum, and I really don't want to break it up.
When you say it should be in a museum, are you trying to sell it to museums?
No, I would like to see it ended up in a museum eventually because I don't want to see everybody just you know piece it all off because there's only one collection in the world like it, and this is it.
Well, but if it's worth $1 million or more, there must be plenty of Beatles fans who don't have $1 million to spend.
Exactly. Yeah, there's so many that would like to have it, but there's only a certain few who can afford it.
What do you say to people who would like to buy, say, a portion of it?
I tell them I'm not breaking it up. I won't break it up.
And why are you not breaking it up? Is it just because, well, you said earlier you don't want to see it broken up, but is that maybe because of financial reasons too?
No.
Would you make more money if you broke it up?
I'm not sure if I would or not, to be honest with you. I don't know. But to me, I like to keep the records together as a group. This is the best collection in the world. I like to see them together as a group.
Mm. Could you tell us when you started collecting Beatles memorabilia?
I started in 1988.
In 1988. Why did you start then?
That's when I felt like I was ready to start buying, this stuff.
Why? Did you come across something?
I came across a record in a store that I wanted, so I just started buying it, and then I started. I went to San Francisco Convention and picked up a gold mine and started talking to certain dealers, and that's just how this started. This is back in like 89, 90 by now.
What's gold mine?
Gold Mine's a record magazine for record collectors.
I see. Did you just start liking the Beatles at that time in 1988?
No. I liked the Beatles the first time I heard I Want to Hold Your Hand back in 1963 in December.
And is that your favorite song?
Yes.
Okay, well, we have it lined up because I knew it was your favorite song.
So all right.
Let's listen to a bit of it and then tell us why you like it.
Okay.
To Hold Your Hand, of course, by the Beatles. Stan, what is it you like about that song?
Well, that was just the way the song was, the voices, the way the beat was, his new sound. I loved it.
Is it still your favorite?
Yes.
Now, of course, there are many different kinds of Beatles songs and different eras of Beatles music. Do you prefer the early Beatles or the mid Beatles or the late Beatles?
I prefer the early Beatles better, but I love all the songs. I love all the songs quite a bit, but I like the early Beatles just a little bit more. You know, the old Beatle boots and the old Beatle haircut.
Yeah.
And the suits. Yeah.
Which is more collectible, the early, mid, or late Beatles?
Early Beatles would be more collectible than the later Beatles in general.
And why is that?
Because most of those records were played to death, and so there's very few around that are really in good condition versus their later numbers.
Now, you have a lot of mint recordings of the Beatles. They're mint, meaning that you have not broken the seal and played the record.
That's correct. Plus, or the record's never been played, even though, it's not wrapped, but the record's never been played.
Now, people usually buy records so that they can play them and enjoy listening to them. Why do you buy records without opening them?
Because I don't want to ruin them. If you start playing them, then what are you going to do? Then they're gone. Because as you keep playing, the sheen gets off the records, the disc. I won't do that to mine. Mine was bought to play. They were not bought to play. I've got my CDs. Therefore, you kept them as they are.
Do you have versions of all the Beatles songs as well in a collection that you can play?
I've got different ones, yeah, like the BBC and some other type of stuff that, I guess you call unauthorized releases.
Stan Panenka is the owner of what he calls the Ultimate Beatles Collection. He's put it up for sale. How many people have expressed interest in your collection?
Several have expressed interest, but so far I have no offers. But, well, you never know.
You've had no offers?
Pardon?
You've had no offers,
I have had no offers, but, some interest, and you never know. When you're talking $1 million, there's a lot of money.
You had hoped to sell it in late November. What are you going to do if it gets to the end of November and you haven't had an offer for the entire collection?
What am I going to do? I'll go ahead and just pull it off the market and wait later on until next year.
And what are you going to do about your mother's house?
I'll just have to wait. I will not break the collection up. I made that known to many, many people who have inquired about me breaking it up. I told them I will not break it up. It is not to be broken up. If you want it, come and get it. You got the money? Okay.
But what about people who live too far away from here and can't come and physically see your collection? How are they supposed to know that it's authentic?
They can talk to record dealers. I've got a lot of references on my website. Perry Cox, John Tefteller, Gary Hine, Bruce Spies, who's an attorney. All those guys are the best references in business. They can ask them. The contact information is there.
Perry Cox is the man when it comes to the Beatles, is it not?
Right.
Doesn't he have a bigger or better collection himself?
No. He's a dealer. He just gets them in and sells them.
Why wouldn't he buy your collection?
He doesn't have the money. He told me he said, I wish I could buy your collections, Dan, but I don't have the money.
Yes. Could you tell us how you're handling the sale? I mean, how does it work? If someone was interested in buying this, what would they have to do?
Well, for right now, I turned it into an auction. So what they have to do, they have to register, and then the bidding starts this Friday. They got 4 days to put in their bid.
And how does it work? Over the internet?
No, they phone me. I take bids that way.
Okay. Getting back to your collection, is there something that you don't have in your collection that you wish you did?
Oh, a few items. White Label promo, Hear the Bills Tall on the VJ label. The mono portrait cover. I've got the stereo, but I don't have the mono portrait cover. That's mm-hmm. about the two things. They're in the top 10 of the most collectible items. I have the other eight.
And why don't you have those two?
I was offered them several times, but not in the condition I wanted. I wanted a minimum near mint, and they had to be the best in the world, or I passed. And I passed on every time people offered me, I passed on it because they weren't the best in the world. They had to be a certain condition.
You say your collection is worth $1 million or perhaps more. Hasn't it cost you an awful lot of money to buy all this stuff yourself?
Well, it cost me quite a bit of penny, yes. To put the collection together over the years, yes, it did. Absolutely.
Could you have bought your mother a home with the money you spent on all this?
The home wouldn't be good enough. The home wouldn't be good enough. The home I'm looking for my mom has to be a special home, not just a regular home. It's got to be up. my mom's the best mom in the world, so I want her to get the best, not just your average home.
And finally, Stan, we talked about your favorite Beatles song, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yes.
I'm just curious, what's your least favorite famous Beatles song?
Number nine, off the White Album. That's really not a Beatles song between Yoko and John doing Albert Garnet.
Yes.
That's my least favorite. Even though I like it, but it's my least favorite, and I really don't consider it a Beatles song. Neither do, most other people.
Yeah, I'm not too keen on it myself either, so... Okay, well, thank you very much, Stan. I appreciate you joining us.
Okay, well, thanks for the interview. I appreciate it.
Okay, and good luck.
Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Stan Panenka. He's the owner of what he calls the Ultimate Beatles Collection. He's put it up for sale. He's hoping for $1 million or more, but as you heard, he hasn't had any bidders yet, but hopes to do this by the end of November. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, in a typical city, incomes and homeownership go hand in hand, but not in San Francisco. The city's highest homeownership rates are in places where average incomes are lowest. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow on Insight, you'll hear from candidates who ran against incumbents and lost in the recent election. Also, how a Davis nonprofit plans to help 100 million of the world's poorest families. And later this week, Loveline's Dr. Drew is coming to Sacramento. Plus, folk singer and storyteller Utah Phillips performing live in our studio. San Francisco Magazine recently did a story titled, What Happened to Black San Francisco? It was about the steep drop in the city's African-American population. One sentence really caught my attention. It read, Bayview has the highest rate of home ownership in the entire city, and 61% of those homes are owned by African-Americans. End of quote. Bayview is the largely African-American neighborhood in southeastern San Francisco, where per capita incomes are among the lowest in the city. I figure this must be unusual, a high level of home ownership coupled with relatively low incomes. So I looked a little deeper. It turns out that the part of San Francisco with the highest per capita income has one of the city's lower rates of home ownership. We got this information from data broken down into San Francisco's 11 county supervisor districts. Bayview is in District 10. The area with low home ownership and the highest per capita incomes is District 2, which includes Marina and Pacific Heights. We thought we'd find out what's going on here. Let's start with longtime San Francisco realtor Bob Evans. He's based in the Sunset neighborhood. He's been selling homes since 1978. Bob, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Could you tell us what it's like how much business there is selling homes up in the northern part of San Francisco, the supervisor District 2, like Marina and Pacific Heights, and compare that with District 10, Bayview, Hunters Point, and so on.
7 and 8, those areas, we actually use different codes by our realtor maps, but I will try to do my best to answer your questions. Areas 7 and 8 are primarily income property rental unit buildings. Probably, I would guesstimate 70% are apartment buildings ranging from 1 to as many as 30 units. So that might be one reason why the figures that you quoted are correct. On the opposite end of the scale, in Area 10, which is Hunters Point, Bayview, we also include on our maps the Excelsior District, Portola, Visitation Valley, Crocker Amazon, Outer Mission, and an area called Mission Terrace. And the reason that the homeownership in these areas is very high is because we do have not only African-American community, but we have a very strong Chinese-American community. The phrase we use is ABC, American-born Chinese. We also have a large influx of monies coming from overseas, and these monies are being used, interestingly enough, Spanish population in these areas, many of them are homeowners. So we have three influences. We have foreign buyers, both from Mexico as well as from China. We have local persons who have sons and daughters, and they wish to purchase homes for them. And these Area 10 is probably the last least affordable area in San Francisco, the last affordable area, whereas District 7 and 8, the Marina and Pacific Heights, are probably the least affordable areas.
Could you give us an idea of the cost of homes in these two parts of the city?
Yes. You cannot get a condominium one-bedroom in Pacific Heights for purchase for anything less than $750,000. That may or may not include one-car parking space. Versus in the Bayview or in Crocker Amazon, I just sold actually a two-unit building there. One of the properties was tenant-occupied. The other one was being delivered vacant, and that went for $810,000.
Could you also give us an idea of how you've seen the kind of business you do change in these two parts of the city over the years? In other words, the kind of people who are buying, the kind of people who are selling?
Let me take the sellers first. The majority of sellers in the Marina and Pacific Heights area are generally young, mobile, average age about 30 to between 30s and early 40s. The majority of the properties are, as I mentioned, condominiums or what we call TICs, tenant in common properties, and they are being purchased by the same age group. If we contrast that to Area 10, the buyers run the entire gamut of young people with parents putting down payments for them and them earning good income so that they can make the monthly payments. The sellers of Area 10 are generally older retiring couples, people relocating out of the city, either because of retirement concerns or because of relocation job situations. And the buyers, as I said, range in all ages. So it's more of a melting pot, let's say, in Area 10 versus in Areas 7 and 8.
Bob Evans is realtor and sales manager of Evergreen Realty, located in the Sunset District of San Francisco. Let's bring into the conversation Espanola Jackson, who's a homeowning resident of San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood. Espanola, thank you so much for joining us in our program.
You're more than welcome.
How long have you lived in Bayview?
I lived in Bayview since 1948.
That's quite a long time.
Yes, it is.
Have you owned your home all that time?
No, I bought in 1968, and at that time, the buyer to buy a home here in San Francisco was like from $26,000 to $36,000.
And is that the kind of range that you paid for your house?
I did. In 1968, I paid $26,000.
Well, congratulations to you.
For a three-bedroom. But you can't buy that now. You can't even buy a doghouse for that amount here in San Francisco.
That's not even a down payment.
What do you think you would get for your house today, Espanola?
Today I would get like around $700,000 to $900,000 today.
That's a shocking amount of money. Is it tempting to you to sell?
Not to me, but it is. It was tempting for quite a few people to sell in the last 10 years. And one of the reasons is because in San Francisco, it was not until 1954 when the integration law was passed that blacks were able to buy. And that's how the buyer's market at that time, a real estater would sell a house to a black, say, in the Bayview, because we were not allowed in the Bayview at that time. We was only in Hunters Point. That's what a lot of people are not aware of. Mm-hmm. And when the blacks would buy in, well, the whites would move out. And that's the reason a lot of blacks became homeowners back in the 50s and 60s like myself.
Have you ever thought about selling your home?
No way.
And why not?
Because of the fact, if I sold here in San Francisco, what would I be able to buy outside of San Francisco?
Bob, do you get much interest from longtime residents like Espanola? Not Espanola, of course, because she's not interested in selling.
Mm-hmm.
But are there a lot of longtime residents in Bayview and nearby neighborhoods who seem interested in selling these homes they've owned for decades?
But only under several circumstances. One, unfortunately, is through death, where one of the either the husband or the wife pass away, and the wife no longer wants the memories of the property. Number two, retirement. The monies from the San Francisco market can purchase an area, for example, Santa Rosa, Sacramento, or in the Lower Valley. You could purchase a home down there and have monies left over to live on. And then the third is where the home has become unmanageable for them. We have 99/9 of our properties have stairs. And a lot of time, older residents can no longer manage going up and down the stairs, can no longer manage keeping up the maintenance on the property, and so they consider selling for those three reasons.
Espanola, how has Bayview changed over the years, as far as you can see?
Well, the change have came, like he had stated in the beginning, there's a lot of Asians that has moved into the community, as well as Latinos into Bayview Hunters Point. But one of the things he don't mention is the fact that if a person sell, like my property tax is like $300 a year, but if I would, and that's within the range that I'm able to pay because of the fact that I'm retired, but if I would purchase property someplace else, it would be like a first-time buyer in another area, and my taxes may be, property tax may be like $2,000 or better a year, and that is something that most older people, and like myself, retired people, cannot afford to buy because of the fact we can't pay the amount, and then the houses are foreclosed on a lot of the people in this community.
Why do you think so many homes are owned in Bayview and Hunters Point compared to some other parts of San Francisco?
As I stated in the beginning, it was not until 1954 that blacks was able to buy because you couldn't live next door to white people prior to that time. And then we just start, people start buying. And now most of those people that bought in, you know, like in 54 up to now, well, through the 60s, they retired. And then they got old. A lot of people have passed. The children sold the properties and because they didn't want to live in San Francisco, and they left.
Are you concerned that this could change, that home ownership could fall in Bayview?
I'm very much concerned about the fact that this area have been made a redevelopment area, and that will mean that with the takeover, there'd be eminent domain and Bayview Hunters Point and the proposed plan, but I'm glad to see it was killed today of bringing the 49er plan and the Olympic air plan to come into Bayview Hunters Point because that would mean a lot of condominiums, you know, $1 million condominium because Bayview is the best area in San Francisco. We don't have fog. We have a lot of sun and plenty of beautiful view.
Also with us is one of San Francisco County supervisors. It's the District 2 supervisor, Michaela Alioto-Peer. Supervisor, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
When I look at the stats for your district, it's the highest per capita income in San Francisco, $76,000, the latest figures I can see here,
yeah.
But very low home ownership, 27% only. Why is it that so few people in an area with such high incomes own their homes?
Well, it's, you know, I have I've lived in this community my whole life, just like Espanola. Nice to have you on there, Espanola.
Thanks, sweetheart.
You know, it is a little more transient. District two is than it's ever been. District two is interesting. We have fewer children, particularly between the ages of 5 and 17, and fewer middle-aged adults, 40 to 69, in District two than at the city as a whole. And we have a lot more young adults between the ages of 25 and 39. So what happens in District 2 is we get a lot of young people who, the other thing that I think is very interesting is that, let me just throw this one out there too, is that we have fewer residents and family households than San Francisco does in general, 45% versus 63%. And correspondingly, more residents and non-family households than citywide. And as a result, what we really see are a lot of young people moving into District 2. They're living with their friends. They are renting apartments. We are seeing that once they get married and have children of kindergarten age, so they're raising their kids here up until they're five, then they realize that they can't afford both the school system and an expensive home, and the homes in District 2 are extremely expensive. And so they're leaving, and they're going to, you know, Burlingame and San Mateo and Novato and Napa and different parts of, you know, different bedroom communities surrounding the city.
We heard earlier from Bob Evans that that the homes in the Bayview, Hunters Point area are a lot cheaper than they are in Marina, Pacific Heights, and so on. Are you finding people moving from District 2 to Bayview, Hunters Point, where their higher incomes can more easily perhaps afford to buy a home?
Well, you know, I'll be honest, I have not seen any numbers of people moving from District 2 into District 10. It would surprise me. I do see a lot of people actually just up and leaving the city. We also have a lot of people from District 2 who, if they can afford it, will move into the Richmond. But we are seeing less of that. I do think that when I look at communities like District 10, I think it is really interesting that District 10's got the highest home ownership rates in the city and that we have the lowest. We have the highest renters in District 2. And I do also believe that some of that is that people in District 10 are investing in San Francisco. They're staying. They're raising their families here. You know, Espanola gave you some pretty interesting numbers, I thought. It cost her not so much to buy her home when she bought it. And now, you know, it could probably be sold for a little under $1 million. That's a lot of money. And it's a lot of money for anybody. But as a result of that, you know, we're not seeing the types of investments that, in my opinion, we really need, particularly if we want to keep families in San Francisco.
Also with us is Larry Rosenthal, who's executive director of the Berkeley Program on Housing and Urban Policy. He's also a lecturer at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He recently co-authored Price High on a Hill, a study of housing affordability in San Francisco. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you.
Could you give us your thoughts based on the conversation we've been having?
Well, it's fascinating to hear these tales from the different vantages. First of all, I would point out that this kind of analysis we would do on a particular unit of what is it? Is it a renter or is it an owner-occupier? It's a very thin analysis. We'd knock on the door. They'd say, who's there? We'd say, are you a renter or an owner? They'd tell us and we'd leave. And there are actually a lot of very complicated factors, and they're determined by the regional economy rather than by the economy of a local campaign precinct, for example. You know, one of them has to do with the quality of the schools, or at least the perceived policy of schools, and the supervisor was getting at that. Two-thirds of San Francisco households are renters. You know, that really turns the logic of the American dream on its head, but that's the nature of the city. It's also the nature of the city's politics. So, in fact, those political forces, two-thirds renters, steadily vote to protect renter interests and to punish, in many cases, ownership interests, and that's where we see this extremely stringent regulation of condominium conversions. If we didn't have that numerical regulation of condominium conversions, we may have a lot more home ownership in the areas where we see less of it. There's other very complicating factors. I don't want to use up all of your time on my answer, but one thing I would point out is San Francisco has become a bedroom community for the Silicon Valley. These high-income people who are renters need to stay mobile. Their jobs have been extremely unreliable in the recent changes in the dot-com economy, et cetera. They don't cast their lot with one employer for a lifetime until retirement. No, they take their human capital with them.
And you're more mobile when you rent.
Absolutely. And that mobility really is the point. But I think that Espanola's story is key here. Even if there is some wealth in the housing stock, that doesn't mean that that wealth wants to move or that they would find other opportunities in the city they love without being priced out of that city.
Larry, how unusual is San Francisco in this respect, where you've got parts of the city with lower incomes having high home ownership and the opposite in another part of the city?
Well, in general, when we think about housing policy nationally, San Francisco isn't a good place to use because it breaks all the rules. Part of the charm of the city has always been its mobility. Part of the charm of the city has always been the way that it attracts a diversity of individuals from ethnic backgrounds, from economic stations. And it's the case that the city has not competed well for the most stable, lower-income jobs, moderate-income jobs, and has now really become a residential plant, less than a manufacturing and industrial plant. And that's why we have part of these kind of idiosyncratic conditions that you've gotten interested in.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to check in with each of you. Given the strange nature of San Francisco real estate, the unbelievable prices, low home ownership in many parts of the city, and so on, how do you feel about the future livability of San Francisco? We just have a few minutes left, so let's start with Espanola. Yes.
There are four developers here, and they're building over 3,000 homes, affordable homes, as well as townhouses. It's a hidden secret in the Bayview Hunters Point area. But we will, and those homes will be selling like from 400,000 to 700,000 range. And they are going to be a beautiful area to live. But it seemed like it's a secret, and they don't want the growth.
Mm. Bob Evans?
We went through a slowdown in our marketplace. So far this year, I've sold about 17 homes. I have three more that are on the market, and one of them will be going into escrow tomorrow. So based on my experience, the money that is coming into the city is not hurting us as far as sales or as far as marketability, because there's always – I'll give you a perfect example. I had a fixer-upper.
Yeah.
Okay. Priced at $650,000. I had it open Saturday and Sunday. I had 351 people through the house, and I have six offers coming in tomorrow morning.
My goodness. Michaela?
I think it's interesting. San Francisco, one of our main objectives is to try and keep families in San Francisco. And Espinola was talking about some of the housing that's going on in District 10. We also need to make sure that we're looking at our first responders. 70% of our first responders live outside of San Francisco. People in San Francisco are renters. You know, I think Larry said that as a result of that, we see that people vote like renters, although there are trends like in District 2 where although we've got the highest percentage of home ownership, people here believe that someday – I'm sorry, renters – people believe that they will own homes. And so in District 2, although they are all renters, more or less, 74% of them, they're still voting with home ownership.
And very quickly, Larry?
I think the fundamentals in San Francisco are strong. One of the maddening realities of the home price market in San Francisco is that it's such a fabulous place. It will continue to be a fabulous place, and people will want to live there regardless of what it costs.
Well, thank you all very much. Larry Rosenthal of UC Berkeley, Espinola Jackson of the Bayview Neighborhood, Bob Evans, Realtor, and Michaela Alioto-Peer, San Francisco County Supervisor. Thanks all.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, the band Dragonfly mixes American pop with sounds from South Asia, and it's rocking audiences from Boston to Bangalore. That's Dragonfly and the day's news next on the world. Today's associate producer was Natalie Breen. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. How do you run a campaign against an incumbent member of Congress in a relatively safe seat? Next time in Insight, you'll hear from candidates who ran against incumbents and lost in the recent election. Also, you'll hear about a Davis nonprofit's plan to help 100 million of the world's poorest families. Plus, you'll meet a Buddhist monk who's also a member of the Tibetan Parliament in Exile. He's speaking in Sacramento next week. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.